Welcome to the Faith Element Podcast for the February 25, 2018 session, focusing on Genesis chapter 17, verses 1 through 16. What's in a name? I'm David Cassidy.
I'm Daniel Glaze.
I'm Seth Oppenheimer.
And I'm Bert Montgomery.
Now, Seth was with us for our last episode and is back with us again. We really consider him to be our rabbi. Beyond his teaching responsibilities, Seth serves as the director of the undergraduate research for the Shackles Honors College of Mississippi State University. And since 2007, he served the B'nai Israel congregation in Columbus, Mississippi. Seth, we're glad you're back with us.
It's always a pleasure.
Well, we continue to be in Genesis. And Bert, this week we have a somewhat uncomfortable passage. I'm wondering if you might have a way to get us started into our look around this one.
Yeah, that's a nice way to put it, David. William Shakespeare once wrote, his Romeo once said, "What's in a name? That which we call a rose by any other name would smell as sweet." Now, my formal first name is Robert. Robert's on my birth certificate, it's on my driver's license, but nobody has ever called me Robert, not even my parents, not even when they were mad at me. They were determined that people would not confuse my father and me. Both of us were named Robert, but we had different names. He was Bob, and from the moment I entered this world, even to this very moment, I am Bert, except for one very proper and excellent high school teacher who insisted on calling me Robert because that was what was printed on registration. It drove me crazy. But today, I kind of like it that to her, we're still in touch. I'm Robert. It's kind of neat. Bert to everybody else, Robert to her. But apart from that, Bert just feels like me. Maybe I've grown into it. I don't know how all that works, but my name says something. I don't know what, but as much as I want to believe Romeo, as much as I want to believe Shakespeare, and I certainly understand the sentiment that Romeo was expressing, I can't shake the notion that names alter our experiences with people. God seems to always be changing people's names, as if a person by another name does make a difference. Paul was first Saul, Peter was first Simon, and Jacob, the heel, later becomes Israel. And in our text today, there's an old man named Abram and his old wife named Sarai. They encounter God. Excuse me. They encounter God, and they learn that they will become the parents of an entire nation of people. And at 90 years old, mind you, God changes Abram's name to Abraham, which means father of many people. And God changes Sarai to Sarah, or Sarah, which means princess of many. But Abraham and Sarah aren't the only ones with different names in this text. Hebrew scholars point to the different ancient Hebrew variations and traditions that were being brought together and merged into one story. Traditions with different ways of speaking of God, of understanding God. And in this Hebrew text from Genesis, in these few verses, God is mentioned by the name, which we often pronounced Yahweh, which in traditional Judaism, which in traditional Judaism isn't even pronounced. God is also mentioned as Elohim, the general Hebrew word identifying God, and also El Shaddai, which could mean anything from God of the mountains to God of the mother's breasts. So while we see two names for one woman and two names for one man, we immediately encounter three names, references, for God, the one God. Each of the names of God carried with it different meanings and different ways of understanding and relating to God. Now, there's another aspect of this story, as David kind of pointed out at the beginning, and that involves relating to God, which means being marked. This story involves a covenant with God and all the descendants of Abraham and Sarah and circumcision. So I'm glad that Rabbi Seth Oppenheimer is with us to help us understand more about circumcision and the covenant, which apparently the word cut is identified with covenant. How appropriate. But I want to close with some words about it from Barry Banstra, an Old Testament or Hebrew Scripture scholar. He says that circumcision established itself within Judaism as a premier mark of the covenant, a premier mark of the covenant commitment. Sealing the covenant by circumcising the organ of procreation with a knife and its obvious threat of infertility has the effect of symbolically handing over the possibility of offspring to the grace of God. Now, remember that in the context of two people who weren't able to have kids. By practicing the rite from generation to generation, the Israelites almost literally placed their future into the hands of the God of the covenant. Whatever name we use for God, and whatever name we use for ourselves, and I don't know if there's another word for circumcision or not that would make us feel any better. This is all a little bit of background for our text today, and I'm going to shut up and let Seth speak.
Why do I have to speak? One thing I want to point out is sign of the covenant. So it's an ot. It's a symbol, a mark of the covenant. It is not the covenant. So later on, the rabbis would rule that if a child's health was in danger, that you did not circumcise. If a child was born sickly, you waited till it was well. If there was a history of children dying in this family because of circumcision, you simply did not circumcise. It's also important to note that it is a sign of the covenant, and yes, it's carried by men, but women are also included within the covenant. And within the naming ceremony, some modern Jewish liturgists will say that women have built into their bodies a connection to the cycles of the world in terms of the lunar cycle, and that they are already marked from birth within the covenant because of their connection with the natural order, which traditionally is ordained by God. There is a tradition of name changing, as you noted, so that among Eastern European Jews, it was quite traditional that if someone had a deathly illness, they would be renamed so that the angel of death could not find them. So that's perhaps a bit of folk religion. My teacher's teacher did have a habit of renaming people if he thought that they had, he would ask first, but if he thought that their name somehow didn't fit them. I was very happy when I met him and he said, "Seth, that's a very good name." This is noted as the covenanting, but there are many other places here where God and Abraham make promises to each other. When God tells Abraham, "Lech lecha," which could be translated "go into yourself," but is usually translated as "go forth," in his act, Abraham is assenting to a covenant which agrees that you will be blessed and through you the nations of the earth will be blessed. And then God repeatedly makes promises about your children will have, you know, inherit this land, and this happens multiple times. So this is particular because of the idea of circumcision present as a sign of the covenant, but there are several places in the story of Abram and then Abraham where this idea of an agreement, a covenant, a brit, is discussed.
So I'm curious. I admit I should have done some reading on this, but I'm intrigued by verse 13 here. Well, actually verses 12 and 13, that the circumcision was to be done even including the slaves born in the house and the one born with your, born in your house and the one bought with your money. From any foreigner who is not your offspring. And I assume some of these slaves would have been foreigners. So could that be seen as either, I mean, I guess it could be seen as an oppressive act that you do this also to your slave, or as an openness to those who might have traditionally been outside the covenant brought into it?
I would say that I think this is in Leviticus where they're talking about being able to eat the sacrifices. Mm-hmm. So if you have a servant or a slave who is circumcised, they can eat of the sacrifices. But if they're not, they cannot. Hmm. So it may be a retrojection where being able to partake within certain aspects of the of ritual life, including eating meat, which at one period would have had to been obtained from sacrifice until the centralization of worship. You know, that comes up in Deuteronomy, which is quite late. If your servants are going to eat, they need to be in a state of some sense in a state of ritual purity, which for males apparently required circumcision. But this, I'm just speculating at this point.
Mm-hmm. I guess I was curious beyond that practical nature, whether it would be seen as some sort of openness or inclusion of.
Well, there was the idea of you have to love the stranger, right?
And
you're not allowed, they have to be judged according to the same standards of justice, and they're a protected class along with widows and orphans, right? Not necessarily those who have been brought in as bond servants. But also, if someone is in the community, I think the tradition was in the third generation, they're admitted to the covenant, admitted to the community. And I'm just drawing that out of my memory. I could be talking through my hat. So there may be some of that there, and I just don't know.
I found an interesting commentary from a Lutheran professor in Minnesota on this text. And I'm just going to throw this out there and we discuss it however we want. But this idea of covenant, and it starting with Abraham and Sarah's own childlessness and this moment of anxiety versus the promise of God's going to make him a blessed nation. Of course, Sarah laughs and having children, all that stuff. But then she points out this promise sets up a narrative drama that follows the Israelites and is repeated over and over again. Over and over again, the descendants of Abraham will face obstacles to the realization that the promise may not happen. Barren women, the patriarch's migration out of Canaan, enslavement in Egypt, desperation in the wilderness. The pattern adds literary interest and theological poignancy to the story. Will God, can God keep the promises? It's a story that stretches not only across the Pentateuch, but also across the Bible as a whole. When Israel finds itself in exile in Babylon, it will ask again, has God kept these promises or has God abandoned us? I've never thought of it in that powerful way of a large story.
Which then leads to the theology of blaming the victim in Babylon. And there's another thing that's set up here, the doubt that you will have children, right? Because we have enter Hagar, enter really messed up family dynamics. When I teach this to kids who are 11 and 12, or just talk about it with my congregation, I refer to Genesis as the story of our dysfunctional family, because it's set up with Abraham and then Isaac does it, plays favorites. Jacob does it, plays favorites. We don't get a healing until the end of the Joseph novella. And even there, the brothers feel the need to lie to Joseph that Jacob said, don't mess with your brothers after I die, even though he didn't say that. So there are lots of dynamics that start with Abraham and Sarah.
Just this interesting idea, Seth, and this again is a Protestant, lifelong Protestant upbringing understanding of Judaism. So it could be very wrong. But, we always talk, everything's Father Abraham, Father Abraham, Father Abraham. And that's all patriarchal and all of that culture and stuff. But are there streams of traditions that emphasize Mother Sarah?
Well, I think even within the biblical text, Sarah has a certain amount of agency, right? And Abraham goes and he pimps her out twice, pimps her out to the Pharaoh, and then later on. And then that story is repeated with Isaac and Rivka. But women often, so who does God talk to directly in the Isaac story? Does God talk directly to Isaac? No, God talks directly to Rebecca, to Rivka. But of course, when we read these texts, they're products of their times, right? They're products of their societies. So as stunning of a reform as the Hebrew Bible is relative to surrounding societies in any number of ways. So for instance, you cannot punish a family member for somebody's crime. The rich and the poor are subject to the same laws. There are lots of reforms like this in the Hebrew, in just the Torah. It's still male dominated and male controlled. So whether it can be properly called a patriarchy or not, I don't know. But we have that issue with our traditional texts. So when we bless boys, we use the blessing of Joseph in some sense. May you be like Menachem and Ephraim, the sons of Joseph, right? But when we bless girls, we say, may you be like Sarah, Rebecca, Leah, and Rachel. So they are remembered in that blessing.
Well, we've had two passages in a row now out of Genesis, both dealing with covenant. What's the new element or the additional layer of understanding around covenant that this passage adds over the Noah story that we began with last week?
Well, Abraham is active. So at the very beginning, he follows the commandment to go forth and leaves everything behind. In the passages we read here, the implication is your children will follow my ways. So there is that agreement. And I do not like this reading of the Akedah, of the binding of Isaac, but there are those who would say that Abraham was absolutely obedient and loyal, though looking at the Sodom and Gomorrah response might cause us to pause and think of a different interpretation of that story. But there is the implication, more implication of mutuality than in the Noah story. And it starts with the very action. There's a lovely story that says that the burning bush on Mount Sinai had been burning since the beginning of time. It's just that Moses was the first one to turn aside and look. Who's to say that the voice of God was not calling someone to service since the beginning of time? And Abraham was the first one, or Abram was the first one to listen.
No, I just want, well, I was just, it's interesting from the Christian perspective, the idea, of course, Christianity is emerging from, coming out of, growing within Judaism. And so, Paul is very important dealing with covenant and trying to plant Jesus in this ongoing covenant, a new covenant. Part of the old covenant. It was just this idea of covenant with God and people is from beginning to end in our scriptures, in the Christian tradition as well.
And Paul had a name change as well.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, I shouldn't push back here, but I will push back a little against Paul here, which is to say what's required of us is not so hard that you cannot do it. Not across the sea that you have to send someone, or up in the heavens that you have to send someone up to get it, but it's right here. It's in your mouth. It's doable. So I think the arguments of Paul about the impossibility of following the covenant is, as I remarked last week, God knows that, yes, we have holy fire, but there's dirt there too. Mm-hmm. And the expectations are conditioned on that. There's pushback, including among some Jewish feminists, to the idea of circumcision. Mm. And the thought that maybe that this is a barbaric practice. Mm. I circumcised my son. I hope that my children circumcise my grandsons. There is certainly pushback even within the Jewish community against this. We've always been a fractious folk.
Well, that's interesting because it follows through with something we were talking about last week, which is the idea of God changing and the idea that maybe it's our understanding of God that's changing.
Yeah. Why do you think we have the same? We have our cycle of Torah portions. You have your lectionary. Why read the same stupid thing every year? It's because you're not the same person when you read it the next year. You've changed. Hmm. You have new insights and new experiences.
But the point is ultimately a sign of the covenant, right? I mean, the covenant is primary, and it seems like certainly the lectionary was intentional about choosing these texts and carrying us from one passage about a covenant to another. And, you know, I think we could talk about circumcision, we could talk about the sign, we could talk about the history.
Well, it's the same word, by the way.
Yes.
The rainbow is a sign.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The circumcision is a sign.
I guess I wonder, do we walk through our lives thinking we are people of the covenant? Or do we, we do need a reminder of that. We do need ways to be reminded that we are people of the covenant, that God's covenant stands.
So two things. First of all, in the Hebrew, la'ot brit, a sign of the covenant, and I think the same language is used about the bow in the sky, that it's a sign, an ot. And Judaism, so I'm sure people are familiar with the idea of a talis, a talit, that has the fringes on it. But there's also the requirement that most non-Orthodox Jews don't do, which is to always wear a garment, an undergarment, that has four corners with fringes on it. So that when you see those fringes, you're reminded of the covenant and you're reminded how to act. There's a story of a student, a rabbinical student, who had fallen in love with a very beautiful and very famous courtesan. And he worked and he worked and he sold everything he had so he would have the money for her fee. So he went into her and he brought her his coins and he saw his talit and he saw his talit katan. He saw the fringes and he just fled, even though he'd given her all the money. And the ending of that story was that the courtesan was so impressed that she turned aside from being a courtesan, went and studied Judaism, and eventually married the student. but the point is that it's there to remind.
Yeah, exactly.
And
it's there to remind that the covenant has ethical responsibilities.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You brought that up with Noah about the ethical responsibilities that people are doing. And I'm saying that because later in the scriptures, even just a few books over in the books of Moses and the Torah and Deuteronomy, they've forgotten their ethical responsibilities. It seems, I may be reading it wrong, Seth, but it seems like, oh, we've been circumcised. We're part of the covenant. We're fine. And God said, no. You're part of the deal. Being circumcised doesn't matter.
Yeah, love the Lord. That the covenant is conditional.
Yeah. Love the Lord your God. Walk in his ways. Love him. Serve him. And then circumcise the foreskin of your hearts, people. Mm. Hmm. Stop worrying about the physical sign.
Any theology that does not have ethical implications is bad theology, right? If it doesn't affect how you live your life, what the heck is it?
So I was just thinking this, a couple places in this passage, we, you know, we're talking about to your offspring, an everlasting covenant. And I don't know what this has to do with anything, but I was just struck by hearing you talk, Seth. The everlasting covenant does not make it an unconditional covenant.
No.
You know, but everlasting does not negate the conditionality of the covenant.
The you know, you look through going to Deuteronomy, you will live in these houses and think that they're your houses, and you'll forget that you're living in houses you didn't build and drinking out of cisterns that you didn't dig. And there, it's warning after warning. And then you come to Amos and the other prophets saying, you know, make your sacrifices, do your circumcision. But if you're abusing the poor, if you're cheating the workmen, this stuff stinks to me. So if the sign, be it a circumcision or a fringe on a garment or a mezuzah on a doorpost, if that makes you say, yeah, I'm right with God, you're not reading it the right way. It's saying you have responsibilities. You are a servant, a partner, perhaps, junior partner. We talk about mankind, humankind being a partner in creation. But that implies action and responsibility.
Well, may we be reminded of our covenant, whatever the sign that helps remind us and brings meaning for us in our commitment, in our part of the responsibility. May it be with us every day. Thank you all for this conversation.
Thank you.
Faith
Element is a service of Faith Lab.